I'm Jessica Lilly. Today on Inside Appalachia, we're taking an Appalachian road trip, and we'll be tasting a lot of food along the way.
It's a lot of fun, not only to build the recipes when you have a passion for food and create the items, but when you know what the result is going to be.
That's Chef Devin Billiter, grilling burgers at a farm-to-table restaurant in southern West Virginia. But our trip will take us outdoors, too. That's the sound of a forest farm in Milton, West Virginia, where Bob Maslowski is growing shiitake mushrooms.
But mushroom people are normal people, if anybody out there is wondering.
Most of the ones I know aren't.
This week also marks an annual biscuit competition in Knoxville, Tennessee. That story and more up next in this special Appetite Appalachia episode of Inside Appalachia.
You know I love that organic cooking. I always ask for more. And they call me Mr. Natural on down to the health food store. I only eat good sea salt, white sugar don't touch my lips. And my friends is always begging me to take them on macrobiotic trips. Yes, they are. All but night I take out my strong box that I keep under lock and key. And I take it off to my closet where nobody else can see. I open that door so slowly, take a peek up north and south. Then I pull out a Hostess Twinkie and I pop it in my mouth.
Welcome to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We Appalachians certainly love to gather with friends and family to eat food that's fresh from the garden and even sometimes from the forest. Chefs across the country are even starting to copy our traditional recipes by serving ramps and cornbread and biscuits for big bucks at fancy gourmet restaurants. It turns out that our grandparents were trendsetters. And chefs here in Appalachia are also experimenting. Many of them are taking old recipes like collards and cornbread or fried chicken and beans and giving those recipes a modern-day twist. Here on Inside Appalachia, we love food. So today we're taking a road trip through the region to find people who are reviving old recipes and bringing something fresh to our plates. This episode is also helping us kick off a new segment on Inside Appalachia, which features restaurants and recipes with Appalachian roots.
Cornbread and butter beans and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Oh, and corn and cotton too, and when the day is
we start in Huntington, West Virginia, where the community is taking an idea from nearby Athens, Ohio, to try to connect local food producers with local food consumers. Clark Davis of West Virginia Public Broadcasting has the story.
That's the sound of Cameron Martin preparing lunch sandwiches on a busy day at the bodega. Susan Ballard is the co-owner of the bodega, a gourmet-style sandwich restaurant.
I am interested in anything that's produced locally. We're always looking to bring new things in. Now that, you know, everybody's starting to plant and things are starting to grow, we're changing our menu to feature a lot more produce.
After doing a taste test with Celeste Nolan of Laurel Valley Creamery, she decided to use locally produced cheeses to top off some of the sandwiches on the menu.
I found a wonderful local cheesemaker. Our new spring menu is going to have three different sandwiches with her cheese on it. I want everyone to taste what an amazing cheesemaker she is and feature our local produce, our local farmers, in any way that we can.
Ballard found the Laurel Valley Creamery through the 30 Mile Mill program. It's a nonprofit organization that works to network farmers with restaurants or consumers within a 30-mile radius of Huntington. Celeste Nolan and her husband run their farm and creamery in Gallipolis, Ohio. It's about halfway between Huntington and Athens, Ohio.
It's been very important to us. Our core customers, both in both cities, are members of the 30 Mile Meal, and our wholesale business really enables us to survive and to grow.
The 30 Mile Meal is a product of the Unlimited Future Incorporated, a business incubator that helps small businesses get off the ground. They foster relationships between local growers, like Laurel Valley Creamery, and restaurants like the Bodega. Since the 30-Mile Mill Huntington program started in 2013, Executive Director Gail Patton has said it's all about bringing the different entities together.
Food, markets, restaurants, anything that has to do with food, any kind of a food business that's located within the 30-mile radius of Huntington has an opportunity to brand themselves as part of this 30-mile meal project.
And now restaurants like the Bodega will have even more local choices to put on their menu, thanks to the 30-mile meal program.
Spinning the heck out of the spinach right now. He looks like he's going slow, but inside that little 5-gallon bucket, that thing is smoking.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
At Adelard Produce, Paul Carboneau and his business partner Sam Torres are rolling spinach. It's a process that cleans any dirt, bugs, or other materials from the recently picked vegetable. Carboneau and Sam Torres are growing vegetables in the west end of Huntington. Adelard Produce opened for business in late fall 2014. Carboneau and Torres are eager to get their product into local restaurants and markets like the Bodega. Carboneau will make a pitch to anyone that will listen.
It's nothing like picking something and cooking it that evening for clientele that come to your restaurant. I mean, it is. The flavor, the texture doesn't compare. I mean, when you cook it up, you look at it and you go, wow, I've been cooking that up for a long time. Never looked like that before. That's because you haven't been picking it local.
West Virginia's weather has created some challenges for the growers. It's tough to have produce during the colder months. It's still a work in progress to figure out the right recipe to make things grow in the winter months, but that's where the high tunnel comes in. It's basically tall metal bars shaped to form a tunnel wrapped in thick plastic. It works as a tube to create better growing conditions when the outside weather isn't so conducive. Growing in the winter months can be the key to creating a relationship with local markets and restaurants. If products can be produced year-round, that can create a more consistent relationship.
You see that they say, well, we can't get this stuff. Well, yeah, when it's in season, you can get a lot of stuff. Sammy and I started this in October. October, November was bad. January was bad. February, we had it covered. We got a little bit of a pick. March got a little bit better, and now we can pick every 3 days.
At Adelard Produce, they're producing things like Bloomsdale spinach, red ruffle, and red Ursa kale, and onions or scallions. Carboneau wants to get the word out about Adelard Produce as quickly as he can. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Clark Davis in Huntington.
And if you're in Huntington, you can buy some of the local products you heard in that story at a local grocery store called The Wild Ramp. Cooking Light magazine just named The Wild Ramp one of the top farmers markets in the country. The Wild Ramp sometimes sells cultivated mushrooms from West Virginia growers, and Appalachian foodies will be interested to hear that the forests in our region could be an ideal environment for growing your own mushrooms. The catch? Well, it's labor-intensive, and if you want to sell your mushrooms to the public, you'll need to show proof that they are indeed edible. Still, there are a handful of people in Appalachia who have been growing shiitake mushrooms for decades. Our producer, Roxy Todd, caught up with a few of these fungi-loving farmers to find out what it takes to grow food in the forest.
Just outside the town of Milton, West Virginia, Bob Maslowski owns a small forest where he grows and collects wild mushrooms to eat. His dogs run circles around us as we make our way up a hill under the shaded canopy of maple and oak trees.
This is kind of a small-scale agroforestry. I have 140 acres here. It's all woodland, and we like to collect mushrooms. We collect about 21 different edible types of mushrooms here.
Maslowski and his wife, Susan, have what is called a forest farm. Aside from mushrooms, they also harvest elderberries, raspberries, and wild onions called ramps from their forest.
These are ramps. We grow ramps on this same hillside. These are all transplanted.
This doesn't look like a traditional farm with rows of crops. This is full of tall shadows from the trees, birds chirping above our heads. Quite idyllic, and not a tractor in sight. Oh, but sometimes you might hear this sound on Maslowski's farm. That's Maslowski drilling holes into oak logs on the edge of his forest. He uses the logs to grow shiitake mushrooms.
These are wooden plugs that are mixed with shiitake spawn.
Mislowski orders shiitake spawn from Wisconsin. The plugs look like these little erasers from a pencil, and inside each one are these tiny, dormant mushrooms. Mislowski then sticks these plugs into an oak log from his forest. Other wood will do for some shiitakes, but oak are generally the best.
These logs will last 4, 5, 6 years, and they'll produce several spawns of shiitake each year.
Then he leaves the shiitake logs on the ground in his forest.
It's close to the house, so you can check them every day. And it's on the north slope in a wooded area, which is well shaded. And you don't want logs in the sun, or they'll dry out too much.
Mislowski has been growing shiitake mushrooms for about 2 decades. This is all mostly a hobby for him and his wife. He's a retired archaeologist, and she's a potter. They also have a small business where they sell homebrew equipment for craft beer and wine hobbyists. They don't raise shiitakes for the money.
Basically, when we have a real good spawn run, good production, we'll take 9 or 10 bags to the farmer's market and sell them for about $3 a bag. It's about 3 ounces. But we, you know, when we're not going to the market, these are enough to feed us with plenty of shiitake. We dry some and we freeze a lot, use them during the winter.
Bob and his wife Susan love to cook with shiitake mushrooms. They make Hungarian mushroom soup and shiitake pizza. They share their latest inspirations at dinner parties and potluck gatherings with friends who also grow and cook local shiitakes.
But mushroom people are normal people, if anybody out there is wondering.
Most of the ones I know are.
But it's not normal Appalachian food. Aside from a few customers at the farmer's market and some of their friends who also grow shiitakes, Mislowski says he doesn't meet many people here who've ever been exposed to specialty mushrooms. Mislowski used to teach an anthropology of food course at Marshall University, where he used to talk to his students about mushrooms.
Like, I had one guy from Kentucky, this is graduate students, said he never ate a mushroom before. And, you know, people just weren't exposed to different foods.
However, there is one wild mushroom that is popular here.
Appalachians really love the morels, and they'll pick them. You know, sometimes you can get a bushel of them in a good place. It's very hard to find. And, they just deep fry them, and it's Kentucky, it's called dryland fish. Whereas you go into the expensive restaurants, and these chefs are buying them for $20, $30, $40 a pound. Most of them come from California. A lot of the chefs around here are starting to buy them locally. One of the problems is, though, you're not allowed to sell wild mushrooms at the farmers' markets.
The health department doesn't want people like Mislowski to sell wild mushrooms at farmers' markets because there isn't a way to inspect those mushrooms to make sure they're safe for human consumption. The reason he can sell cultivated shiitake and oyster mushrooms is because they're grown from spores.
Technically, if you're selling them at the farmer's market, you have to be able to identify the spawn you're using. It has to be a commercial spawn.
Like you're doing.
Yeah, yeah. All I have to do is show them a picture of the bag and say, these are, you know, West Wind shiitake.
It can be difficult to sell wild mushrooms to restaurants, too. Under state law, chefs who want to use wild forage mushrooms have to have a mushroom identification expert inspect every mushroom that is served to the public. But the law doesn't specify what a wild mushroom expert is. The West Virginia Department of Health suggests that local restaurants should reach out to extension agents and mycological societies to find experts who can help identify mushrooms in their restaurant. Another problem for chefs who want to serve wild mushrooms is there just aren't enough people selling them. Mislowski collects morels on his own land, along with other wild mushrooms like chanterelles. But he doesn't sell these. They're too precious. He only collects enough for him and his wife to eat. His hope is to encourage more farmers to start growing shiitakes because he'd like to see the community of mushroom farmers continue to grow in West Virginia.
And what we were hoping by selling shiitake and doing demonstrations at farmers market, we would get more local farmers into it and so on. But the local farmers are very conservative.
By conservative, Maslowski means that most farmers he meets aren't interested in growing exotic or different foods, like shiitake mushrooms. But some people want to see more mushrooms farmed from the forest and getting into the local market. Brad Cochran is an extension agent with West Virginia State University.
There is a lot of demand, especially here in the Charleston-Huntington metro area, because there are so many up-and-coming restaurants and really cool chefs around town that are just dying to get a hold of some good locally grown mushrooms.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear from a farmer in North Carolina who makes about $9,000 a year from selling shiitake mushrooms. You're listening to Inside Appalachia.
Oh, yeah, in the daytime, I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. Oh, but at night, I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me. All right. My friends down at the commune, they think I'm pretty neat. Oh, I don't know nothing about arts and crafts, but I give them all something to eat. I'm a friend to old Yule Gibbons, and I only eat homegrown spice. I got a John Keats autographed Grecian urn filled up with my brown rice. Yes, I do. Oh, folks, but lately I have been spotted with a Big Mac on my breath. Stumbling into a Colonel Sanders with a face as white as death. I'm afraid someday they'll find me just stretched out on my bed, with a handful of Pringles, potato chips, and a ding-dong by my head. In the daytime, I'm Mr. Natural, just as healthy as I can be. But at night, I'm a junk food junkie. Good Lord, have pity on me.
Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry, Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and listen on your own time.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. In this next part of our story about farming shiitake mushrooms, we'll find out why Appalachia is considered an ideal location to grow edible mushrooms.
Forest farmers are generally folks who grow ramps, hazelnuts, maple syrup, and shiitake mushrooms as a hobby, not as an income. But some people would like to see more forest-grown products sold at specialty food stores and at restaurants that serve local ingredients. Extension agent Brad Cochran believes there's a lot of potential to grow this industry in Appalachia.
You know, and if people maybe aren't considering it right now, maybe they should start to think about it, because, you know, our climate here in West Virginia is perfect. We're right about 75% forested, which is a perfect place to grow shiitake mushrooms on logs out in the forested settings.
Cochran studied forestry in college, and he isn't against timbering, but he believes that forests can grow lots of products, not only trees.
If a landowner is, you know, wanting to do a timber harvest, say in 15 years to help send their kid to college, you know, traditionally they would just wait 15 years for a timber harvest. If they look at, you know, mushroom production, in that 15 years they can have, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds of production that they can sell in the local market for $10 to $15 a pound. So you start to look at that, and you may not even have to do that timber harvest.
That vision for forest farming is shared by a small group of professors, farmers, and researchers who are scattered across the country. They wonder, if people can make a living off the forest by making maple syrup, couldn't they do it by growing ginseng, ramps, and mushrooms? Cornell University in New York has a forest on their campus where they're experimenting with forest farming. I attended a forest farming conference there last fall, and I met Ken Mudge, a mushroom researcher and professor at Cornell.
Do you know the fungus joke? Mushroom walks into a bar. Bartender says, "Get out of here. We don't like your kind." Mushroom says, "Hey, what's the matter? I'm just a fun guy." It's stupid, but it's the only mushroom joke I know.
On the tour, I also met Rodney Webb, a farmer from Madison County, North Carolina. He grows about 1,000 pounds of shiitake mushrooms each year.
I originally got into growing shiitakes. My wife had cancer about 17 years ago, Hodgkin's lymphoma, and we started doing some alternative diets type things, and shiitake mushrooms are one of the things that were recommended for us, and she was supposed to have that twice a week. And we were buying dried shiitakes from Japan, and if you're buying them in small quantities, the price worked out to be, you know, over $100 a pound. So.
And so Webb decided that maybe he could grow the shiitakes himself.
Started growing them, and I think they're very beneficial. They're high in protein. You know, it could be up to 18% protein for shiitakes. So if you're a non-meat eater, they're a good source of protein. But I really want to get them out to people to help make a healthier society, because I think that's what we need.
At this time, there isn't a lot of research to support the cancer-fighting power of shiitake mushrooms. At least, there haven't yet been enough studies done on humans. I talked with Lino Stankic, who is a licensed nutritionist who recommends eating shiitakes for their rich nutrient content. Stankic was the one who suggested shiitakes to Rodney Webb's wife 17 years ago. Stankic was born in Croatia, and he grew up in Italy eating wild mushrooms from the forest.
The best mushrooms are the ones who grow in a forest or in lugs, naturally. The other thing also, they have a lot of vitamins. They have vitamin B2, B3, B6. You see, they also have vitamin, as I said before, vitamin D, folate, zinc, and fibers, you know. So it's a food, so it can be used as a medicine and as a food at the same time. It's very good investment in health.
Some of the other things that we you're starting to see through research and new sorts of things are that all of them have a lot of cholesterol-lowering abilities.
This is Extension Agent Brad Cochran again.
They're very organically grown, so they're honestly some of the healthiest things you can eat.
Cochran says he first fell in love with shiitake mushrooms in forestry school because they're cool to grow and because they're delicious to eat.
You know, it's really, really cool, and having the ability to grow them right here in West Virginia is really awesome.
Cochran says he's tried dozens of shiitake recipes, but his favorite is the most basic. He sautés the mushrooms in some butter and some garlic. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd.
On our website, we've posted a few shiitake recipes and information about where you can buy local shiitake mushrooms in Jonesboro, Tennessee, Huntington, West Virginia, and Floyd, Virginia. That's wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly, your Inside Appalachia. Stick around. In the second half of our show, we're going to travel to another farm that uses heritage pigs to plow their fields. Then we'll travel to the International Biscuit Cook-Off in Knoxville, Tennessee. But first, it's time for What's in a Name, a segment on Inside Appalachia that explores the history and folklore of the names of Appalachian places. Mother's Day was just this past weekend, and with this episode focused on food, we wanted to go to Hungry Mother State Park in southwestern Virginia. So where does Hungry Mother get its name? You'll find out after the break. You're listening to Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So how did Hungry Mother State Park get its name? I visited the park for the first time with my mother, and I heard that the park got its name after a mother went out to the woods to find her children food. While in the hills of Virginia, she fell into a snake pit and was bitten. Despite the venom racing through her veins, she clawed her way back to her children to deliver the food, only to collapse and die shortly after.
We checked in with one of the park rangers at Hungry Mother State Park last weekend to ask for the story he knows about where the name originated.
My name's Darren Handy, and I'm a seasonal employee here at Hungry Mother State Park.
And it's a very interesting sounding name. I bet you get a lot of people in here that are wonder where the name came from, as I did. Yeah. So what do you know? What do you tell people?
Back in the colonial type times that, of course, all this never was a park then, obviously, a lot of Indians were settled in the area, especially over in the Tazewell area. People came through and was colonizing everything. I believe it was somewhere over in the Tazewell area that a family was over there, and the agreement was that the Indians wouldn't come there, and then, of course, the white people wouldn't come in the other areas, but some Indians raided the area and killed the husband and took the wife and a little girl and possibly another girl. All this is actually folklore. They don't know for sure if it actually happened or not, but it seems that there's a good chance it was. But Molly Marley was the little girl's name, the infant's name, and then the mother, they killed the father. And they took, the rumor has it that they may have traveled all the way into what now would be Maryland somewhere. Molly's mother was there, and some things happened that they were able to escape. And so they escaped, and they, of course, on foot came back this way. And the story has it that they made it to what we now call Molly's Knob over here, which is the higher point in the park. So when they got up there, of course, they were exhausted. They hadn't had much to eat for days on end. They were by themselves. They don't know exactly if the other child was with her when they took them or if there was another child, but supposedly the little child that was named Molly and her mother made it back down to the park area here. The mother was so exhausted, and for some odd reason she was trying to get to the creek over here, but for some reason she got on top of the high knoll over there, which is now Molly's Knob, popular trail here at the park. And when she got up there, she was so exhausted that she either passed out, fainted, or sat down, couldn't go anymore. So the little child kept coming and made it down to what would be the creek that freed the lake now, and there were some settlers back there working, either logging something. I don't know if they lived there, but anyway, the child heard them, found them near the water, came back to there, and the little child was so small that she couldn't speak full English. I mean, she just hadn't learned to speak yet. So when they got down there, the people were asking her, you know, what's going on, and the only, supposedly, as the story has it, the only thing she could say was hungry mother. And so the men took her and fed her, of course, and things like that, and then they went to find the mother, but by the time they got up to what is now Molly's Knob, then they found the mother there, dispatched. She had passed away. Whether she had passed before the girl left or afterwards, so the mother didn't survive, and we have I believe there's a little plaque area up there at the top of Molly's Knob where they theorize that this happened at. So that's our Molly's Knob, and then the name of Hungry Mother Park comes from the little girl saying the only thing she could say was hungry mother.
If you have another story about Hungry Mother State Park, or if you know of another place in Appalachia with an interesting sound or mysterious folklore behind it, send us a tweet at InAppalachia, hashtag What's in a Name, and we might explore it inside Appalachia. I hope you're not hungry, because on this show, we're talking about food that's making my belly rumble. In Raleigh County, West Virginia, the Dish Cafe is serving up fantastic cuisine that's also good for you. Suzanne Higgins of West Virginia Public Broadcasting reports on the growing popularity of this farm-to-table restaurant.
So I'm going to get going with getting the vegetables grilling.
The look and smell are as great as the sound. Red, yellow, and green peppers sauteing with freshly chopped onion.
So that'll take about 10 minutes. And then I can move on to something else.
Chef Devin Billiter is also operations manager for the Dish Cafe, open now 2 years and located in Daniels, West Virginia, in Raleigh County. It's a farm-to-table restaurant, cooking up their own recipes using local produce and proteins as much as possible.
I'm going to get started on the sauce for the chili. And a little bit later, we'll finish cooking off the beef and season it up and let that simmer down until about 5 o'clock today.
The Italian sausages come from Sherwood Family Farm in Greenbrier County, smoked trout from Gary Redden in Shady Spring, strawberries from a Fayette County grower, Honey and free-range eggs are from Iris Farm, another local producer, and grass-fed beef from Swift Level Farm in Lewisburg. Today, as he prepares for his Taco Tuesday, Billiter is featuring certified Angus beef from a Charleston producer.
It's a lot of fun, not only to build the recipes when you have a passion for food and create the items, but when you know what the result is going to be, that's where the pride comes in.
The result is a healthier and delicious dining out option, and the restaurant is based on a lifestyle lived by all three couples who own it.
You know, it was funny because a lot of people said, oh, you know, people around here don't like frou-frou food. You know, they want everything fried. They're not going to respond well.
Michelle Rodolini is one of the owners.
So we always kind of talked about, you know, we should have a restaurant. You know, we should really show people how great food can be, that you don't have to add things to it to make it taste good. You don't have to add sugar. You can make food taste good by using herbs and spices and things like that, cooking with quinoa instead of flour and agave nectar instead of refined white sugar.
Some of the regular menu items include the falafel salad, Hawaiian flatbread, the roasted porchetta sandwich, and their signature 10-ounce ribeye.
I love their trout. I had it today, and they have it about once a week, so it's excellent. It's an almond-crusted filet of trout. It's really, really good.
I like the avocado brownie and the black bean burger, the grass-fed burger, like she said, the grass-fed beef, and their salads are awesome.
We like to support any restaurant that supports our local economy and our local farmers, and we like to eat the healthier produce.
The chicken tastes excellent.
The dressings are to die
for. Oh, the blue cheese. I love blue cheese, and that's the best dressing of blue cheese I've had. My wife doesn't even eat it, and she's...
Yeah, it's good. It's good, and I don't like blue cheese usually.
Wow, that's a testimony, isn't it?
Among farm-to-table restaurants, Rodolini says the Dish Cafe stands out.
Although there are farm-to-table restaurants, there are no restaurants that are doing production like we're doing. You know, we are a 135-seat restaurant, and we're putting out food that the same way that a chain does. So as quickly and with the variety that, say, an Applebee's or an Outback does.
Serving up this yummy and healthier fare is much more expensive for a farm-to-table effort compared to a chain restaurant. Organic ingredients are more expensive, and cooking from scratch means more hired labor in the kitchen. Billiter points out consistency and volume of the local ingredients are other factors.
The growers know their seasons. They grow as much as they can because they know when the farmers' markets are going to be. Whereas with the restaurants, we have to have quantities, and it obviously would be an estimated quantity based on our guess of what our volume of business is going to be. And moving forward from there, then we have to get to the growers to say, this is how many pounds of green peppers I'm going to need by the week through this quarter, or this is how many Idaho potatoes I'm going to need. It's that challenge there, as well as having an aggregator in between to help get the product from the farms to us, because we can't always get to the farms to get it. And on the flip side, the farmers can't always have somebody getting out to us because they have to be maintaining the farms.
So this coordination with local farmers and the refinement of the product delivery system is still a work in progress and a financial commitment.
We've stayed committed to keeping our prices lower or equal to what our competitors are while we're still using ingredients that cost two times to sometimes five times more than what our local competitors are using. And the success of our restaurant is going to be continued on the amount of volume that we have.
And that's going well. The Dish Cafe is currently rated the number one area restaurant on TripAdvisor. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Suzanne Higgins in Daniels.
This is a song we get a lot of requests for. It's a song that addresses the age-old subject of love and food, called Cornbread Salad.
Yes, good boy.
When a guy lives by himself, he's always out a looking for some gal that looks real sweet and really knows her cooking. Every morning she will fix a plate of sliced tomatoes, biscuits, eggs, and country ham, and a heap of fried potatoes. The other night I met a gal, she set my heart a-twitter, when she told me she knew how to make a great corn fritter. I told her I can't eat no more because I'm getting fatter. Minutes later I forgot with bacon on the platter. Cornbread Sally, Cornbread Sally, you're so darn good looking. Is it love at first sight or is it just your cooking? When I'm standing by the stove, it sets my nose a-twitching. I wish the wedding ceremony would happen in the kitchen. Cornbread Sally, you make my heart flutter when I smell that cornbread all covered.
Even if Backbone Food Farm didn't sit below Backbone Mountain, its name still would be very appropriate. That's because Max Dubansky and his family farm the way he learned from the old-timers, letting pigs turn the soil and using horses to work the land. Jesse Wright of West Virginia Public Broadcasting spent a day on Backbone Food Farm in Garrett County, Maryland, seeing how traditional farming methods are being kept alive in this small corner of the Appalachian Mountains.
I joined Max for a walk around Backbone Food Farm in early spring. The sun was just breaking through the clouds onto a scene of serene, rolling green hills.
Being high elevation where we are here, we like to grow a lot of cool weather crops. So, you know, lots of lettuces and greens, carrots.
The farm also produces several kinds of edible and medicinal mushrooms, along with berries and fruit, so about 25 different crops in all. Max got his love of growing vegetables from his father. His parents moved out to Garrett County from Baltimore in the 1970s so they could grow a large garden. But Max says it wasn't until he left high school that he became interested in farming as a profession. He started caretaking a farm in the area and began learning the trade, mostly through trial and error.
But the biggest asset for me was the old people. The last of the true old-timers were still around, and I learned an infinite amount from just hanging out with those guys about farming in general and working horses and, you know, just making it on a farm without much.
In following those old traditions, animals have become an integral part of the farm.
By having animals, that's definitely helps, you know, keep everything in balance. I feel like, you know, a farm isn't really a farm until you have animals. But, you know, it's personal. Personally, I feel that way. But
that's Max's wife, Catherine. She met Max while they were both working on a small farm outside Flintstone in Maryland. They've been married for 18 years and have 4 children. They began caretaking Backbone Food Farm 16 years ago and bought it outright in 2013. Max says many of the farm's fields were overworked and depleted of nutrients when they took it over.
Hey, pig. Hey, pig. Hey, pig. Hey, pig. And the pigs have just been amazing as far as using their natural inclination to root. We've been able to, like, plow large amounts of ground with them.
The pigs are a heritage breed, aptly called large black hogs. They have black skin and hair and are adapted to living outside.
With the heritage breed, too, they're registered, so there's only, like, 800 of these pigs in the entire country. So we're kind of trying to get the stock back up.
When the weather warms up, the pigs are moved from the barn into the fields.
Pig manure is really powerful stuff. And just aerating the soil up there where they are, we've noticed dramatic improvements in our pastures, like with the grass and clover growth.
Backbone stands out in the surrounding community of small growers because draft horses are used to do most of the work on the farm instead of tractors.
Once the land is plowed, then it's all horse work. We do all the cultivating, all the bed forming, everything with horses.
Tractors are used when time is short, but Max says he feels using a tractor disconnects him from the process of working the land.
You can't hear the birds singing, you can't, you know, you're in a cab, the wind, you can't feel the wind or whatever. Where horses, it slows the work down.
He says working with horses also brings a spirit of cooperation.
It's me and the horses we're all the team that are working together, and I have to pay attention constantly to how they are and how they're feeling, and they're constantly paying attention to me. So it adds this whole another layer and dynamic to the work that I just really enjoy. Makes me feel more involved with everything I'm doing.
We're standing on the edge of what looks like a field of short grass. The land in front of us is broken up into similar patches that extend into the distance. Max says he only grows vegetables every other year on each patch. What looks like grass is actually a cover crop that's used to return nutrients to the soil in the years between vegetable harvests.
This is rye and crimson clover, hairy vetch. There's legumes in here too, which fix nitrogen from the air. So we're collecting free nitrogen.
Max rips a handful of leafy rye from the field we're standing on, exposing the roots and soil beneath.
You can see that little white ball right there.
He points out a white sphere about twice the size of a pinhead attached to the root.
That's actually a nitrogen nodule that the leaves have taken the nitrogen out of the air and affixed it to the root. And then when you plow that in, it rots in and makes it available to other plants.
Max says one advantage he has is lots of land. By using crop rotation and animals to work his fields, he can essentially grow his own fertilizer. So just about everything the farm needs to grow crops is generated on the land. Most of the waste that the animals produce is turned into fertilizer. That fertilizer is used to grow crops. Catherine says using that closed-loop system helps cut down on the amount of pollutants the farm generates.
We like to see the whole, you know, cycle of fertility right here so that we don't have to import fertilizers and we don't have to, you know, there's not a whole lot of extra waste that comes out that we have to find a place for it to go.
On top of growing food for markets and restaurants in the area, Backbone also serves as a place to learn about small-scale sustainable farming. Max and Catherine bring in two or three apprentices a year who stay on the farm for 6 months. Max says apprentices can range in age from 18 to 40.
It's mostly younger people that are interested in farming and want to get an idea of what it actually takes to run a family farm.
Well, I wanted to do some farming. I wanted to learn more about it, more about sustainable farming, and hopefully farm in the future and make a living out of it.
Andy Hinnenkamp grew up in Kansas and went to college in Nebraska. The 23-year-old says she hopes to take what she learns during her time as an intern on the farm back to Kansas.
I think that would be really cool, something that could sustain a life but also make a living.
Passing on knowledge is important at Backbone. Sitting around the kitchen table in his farmhouse, Max says he feels fortunate to have learned from the last of the old folks in the area who use traditional methods.
And so I feel like almost that I'm this bridge, you know, that like I'm really lucky that I caught the tail end of that, and I'm this bridge that can take it to these people in their 20s.
Some of Backbone's apprentices have gone on to start farms of their own nearby. The owners of Round Right Farm in Preston County and Savage River Farm near Frostburg in Maryland got their start under Max and Catherine's tutelage. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Jesse Wright.
You can find Backbone's produce and shiitake logs at the Morgantown Farmers Market. They're also at markets in Frostburg and Oakland in Maryland, where they sell their pork and beef. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This weekend, folks in Knoxville, Tennessee celebrated the International Biscuit Festival. The festival was created in 2009 by a group of local biscuit lovers who wanted to share Knoxville's biscuit heritage with the world. One of the highlights of Knoxville's International Biscuit Festival is the Mr. and Ms. Biscuit Pageant. The winner back in 2013 was Liz Barr. Tanner Latham with the Authentic South podcast was there, and he reports that her win was surely secured after she performed an interpretive dance to an original love song about a biscuit.
Fast car down from the north.
You know, in any other city in the world, a love song about a biscuit would be incredibly odd.
Sat down, took my breath away.
But we're not in any other city in the world. We're in Knoxville, Tennessee, the home of the International Biscuit Festival.
sweet as honey, soft as a pillow where we sleep, warm and buttered, on a plate for me to eat, and I can't go back to NYC.
I'm Tanner Latham, and this is Authentic South. It's a storytelling podcast that explores Southern culture through food, music, art, travel, the land, and lots of interesting characters. So this song about a biscuit, which is curiously titled Biscuit Song, was written and recorded by Megan Lang, who lives in Knoxville.
I like to write songs a lot, so when I called Liz and told her that she had to do the biscuit pageant, we started talking about talents and what she would do, and after looking at the options of songs that were available, we decided that the best way to go about it would be to write our own. So I sat down one night and scribbled out lyrics, because I, like Liz, love biscuits, and I tried to approach it like I would if I were writing a love song about a person. And so eventually the song, Biscuit Song, came to fruition, and there you have it.
Megan is talking about the Mr. or Miss Biscuit pageant, by far one of the most interesting events held during the Biscuit Festival. It's labeled Mr. or Miss because guys and girls are all competing together.
Evie! Hi guys, welcome to the Mr. and Miss Biscuit competition. How's everybody doing? Is everybody pretty much ready for a nap? You're like, I've eaten more biscuits now than I've eaten in my whole life.
Megan also mentioned her friend Liz Barr, who was one of the contestants in the pageant. And as her talent, she performed an interpretive dance to Megan's biscuit song. Now, Liz had some pretty serious competition when it came to the talent portion of the contest. There was a guy named Austin who ate a spoonful of flour. There was last year's Miss Biscuit trying to retain her crown. She was a Liza Minnelli tribute artist who called herself Liza Ms. Jelly. There was a woman named Cheryl who carved a butter sculpture to resemble the Sun Sphere, one of Knoxville's iconic landmarks. As a quick aside, the butter sculpture, which looked like a tall, skinny tower with a bulb on top of it, could be misinterpreted if seen out of context. But that's a different story. And then there was a woman named Gina, who sung an original a cappella piece she wrote to the tune of the Little Mermaid song, Part of Your World.
Who cares? No big deal. I want more. I want to be where the biscuits are. I want to see them eating, chomping around on those, what do you call them? Teeth. Mixing your dough, you don't get too far. Heat is required for rising and browning, rolling around in the, what's the word again? Jam. Up where they chew, up where they eat, up where they pack on pounds in their seats. Wandering free, wish I could be part of your plate.
But then Liz took the stage, and she danced to Megan's original biscuit song.
Fast car, down from the north.
Leaping and pirouetting with great grace and poise, and all the while holding a biscuit delicately in her palm. It was something special.
Ladies and gentlemen, your 2013 Miss Biscuit winner is Liz.
So Liz, you are now the reigning Miss Biscuit 2013. What does that feel like?
You know, it feels really good. I didn't actually think I was going to win, so it's really awesome to come into something that you weren't expecting.
I want you to talk to me a little bit about your talent. That seemed to be one of the things that probably sinked the win for you. Tell me about what you did today.
Well, I did gymnastics for a long time before, and so naturally I can kind of dance or pretend like I know how and know what I'm doing.
So this was an interpretive dance, mm-hmm. you would say, right?
Yeah, definitely.
What kind of inspiration did you draw on for the various moves during the dance itself?
Well, definitely my gymnastics experience, and then since it was a love song about a biscuit, I just decided to do stuff that would show off the biscuit the most and show true love for the biscuit.
So do you think you you got some time to let it all sink in? Is that, I mean, what, how do you come down from a height like this?
You know, I don't really know, but we'll see what happens, what the next couple of weeks bring.
Sweet as honey.
And get this, throughout the month of May, the International Biscuit Festival is hosting a biscuit art exhibition. The exhibit features artwork inspired by, you guessed it, the biscuit. The exhibition will be at the Imperium Center Gallery in Knoxville, Tennessee, and will last through May 31st. Now, speaking of biscuits, I'm starving. If your belly's growling like mine, you can find some recipes on our website at wvpublic.org. Thanks for listening to this special edition of Inside Appalachia to kick off a segment called Appetite Appalachia. It'll be an ongoing segment that focuses on restaurants, recipes, and food with Appalachian roots.
Cornbread and butter beans and you across the table. Eating beans and making love as long as I am able. Pulling corn and cotton too and when the day is over.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Authentic South Podcast and WPAQ in Mount Airy, North Carolina. Music in today's show was provided by Larry Gross, the Carolina Sunshine Trio, Dog and Gun, the Sawtooth Mountain Boys, Ben Townsend, and Sir Mix-a-Lot. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William. Our producer is Roxy Todd. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at WV Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education and more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.